This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hey, this is Trey. Thank you for joining us for a Tuesday edition of our podcast. They call it jury selection, but it's really not. It's jury unselection or deselection. I've seen trials won and lost before the witnesses even utter a word. That's how important the process of picking or unpicking a jury is. States do it differently, and the feds do it a little bit differently from the states. But together, if you're interested and willing, let's take a crash course in how juries are picked or unpicked. But first of all, you get a summons in the mail. Could be based on driver's license information or voter ID information, but you get a piece of paper from the clerk of court telling you, or from the court itself, telling you to show up for jury service. But before you can serve on what we consider a jury, you got to go through a process. Everyone meets in one big room at first. You're asked general questions to make sure that you are legally qualified. Now, what do I mean by legally qualified? Well, some states have education requirements. Some states, like the one I'm in, South Carolina, require that you be able to read and write. But even if you, and I had this with some of my older potential jurors, they didn't finish the sixth grade. But they could read and write. So they met that statutory requirement or qualification. Some states don't allow convicted felons. Some states give senior citizens or people a certain age the right to legally opt out of jury service. All you have to do is raise your hand and say, I'm 65 years old, depending on what state you're in. You don't have to say anything else. Now, you're welcome to stay and serve, but they can't make you do it. So first of all, think qualifications, requirements. Do you meet them? Some people are qualified, but they have plans that cannot be moved. A surgery that's been planned, a non-refundable vacation. And judges do try to accommodate reasonable situations. And then you got to know whether the jury is going to be sequestered, which is a fancy legal word for away, separated, away from their families or not. You know, for instance, in the death penalty cases I handle, the jury was almost always sequestered. So that impacts who is able to serve, who is able or qualified to serve on that jury. So you have legal qualifications. So if you're in a state that doesn't allow convicted felons to serve on the jury and you have been convicted of a crime for which you could have received more than 1 year, you're not legally qualified. You don't need to ask any more questions. You're gone. Done. If you have moved out of the state or out of the jurisdiction, you don't meet the legal requirements. Done. So now we have a smaller group, and that group meets the legal requirements, but you also have to be fair and reasonable and sensitive to the fact that people have lives. So, you know, back to the death penalty cases, if a jury is going to be sequestered and you're the mother of a newborn child, you can't be sequestered with a newborn in a hotel room for 4 weeks. So are you legally qualified to serve? Absolutely. You may even in your well of souls think it's your civic duty to serve. But not this case. So the judge would, upon your request, move you or transfer you to another term of court. And so then once we get all of that taken care of, then we get case specific. All of what we've gone through so far has nothing to do with a particular case. It's just general life. Then we get case specific. And you're going to be asked, do you know the parties? Do you know the plaintiff in a wreck case? Do you know the store owner in a slip and fall case? Do you know the defendant in a criminal case? Do you know the lawyers? Do you know anything about the case? And I use the word know advisedly. Have you read something in the newspaper? That doesn't mean it's true, but have you read it? Have you heard it? Do you know any of the witnesses? I mean, let's be realistic. If your boss is one of the witnesses, are you more or less likely to believe that witness than you would another witness? You'll be asked that. And if you're asked that in front of your boss, you're probably going to say, oh, gosh, no, I would definitely believe my boss no matter what he or she said. Well, then you're not qualified to serve in that particular case because you have to treat all witnesses the same. One of the common questions I used to hear defense attorneys ask is, are you more likely to believe a police officer than you are other witnesses? And some people feel, maybe not as much anymore, but some people back in the old days when I was doing this for a living would sort of feel like they should say, yes, I'm more inclined to believe someone who's a representative of law enforcement. That might get you disqualified or kicked off the case because, again, you got to be willing to believe or not believe any of the witnesses, depending on what they say. And this is when we get to the part that is so fascinating about human nature. Have you already made up your mind? You know, child abuse cases were the hardest because good people do not want to hear about the abuse of a child. So the jurors would tell the judge, oftentimes with tears streaming down their faces, that they could not be fair in a case involving a dead or hurt child. And as a prosecutor, I understand that. I get it. The cases were awful, but we lost so many good potential jurors because they were good people who did not want to sit and listen to such awful fact patterns. I get it. I didn't want to have to listen to it either. The bailiff doesn't want to listen to it. The judge doesn't want to listen to it. The question is not whether or not you want to listen to awful fact patterns. The question is whether or not you could be fair. And when it comes to certain categories of cases, especially ones involving children, many people said, look, I cannot be fair. I cannot be fair. If there is a dead child, I'm going to want to blame someone. I'm not interested in it being an accident. I'm not interested in anything other than punishment. So the answers to some of those questions would not automatically disqualify you from service, but they're certainly going to lead to follow-up questions. For instance, if you know this witness, you're not related to them, but you know them. Would you be more or less likely to believe them? If the answer is no, I wouldn't be any more likely to believe them or not believe them. I treat them like everyone else. Then you're still legally qualified to serve in that jury. Again, we haven't even gotten to the picking or the unpicking of a jury yet. We're still just trying to figure out who's qualified to even potentially serve. I mean, you talk about high profile cases. I mean, who in the world has not heard something about fill-in-the-blank high-profile case? I mean, if you're my age, whether it's Susan Smith, whether it's the killing of the four students in Idaho, whether it's Casey Anthony, whether it's Timothy McVeigh, you fill-in-the-blank, everyone has heard something about high-profile cases. Question is not whether or not you've heard something. The question is whether or not you have made up your mind. Whether or not you could base your decision solely on what happens inside the courtroom, not what some reporter wrote. And then you get asked some very important questions about yourself. And this is where I marvel. And for a cynic to marvel is marvelous. And I am a cynic. I never ceased to be amazed at how often people were honest about themselves. How often people said, no, I don't think I could be fair. Now, you don't have a mini trial, but the judge does read the indictment. I mean, the judge does give you a general idea. For instance, in a drug case, if you really fervently believe that drugs should be legalized, and that's such a dominant thought that you would not be able to be fair to the government, I was amazed in a good way at the number of people who would say that. And I don't think they were just trying to get out of jury service. I think they were being honest. Can you be fair? Can you set aside what you think the law should be and follow the law as it really is? Can you be impartial? Can you wait to make up your mind? That's the thing I love about politics these days, is we are expected to make up our minds almost immediately upon hearing something for the very first time. We hear it and we have to immediately make up our minds. And the jury is told the exact opposite. You are forbidden from even beginning to make up your mind until you have heard everything. And if you think about it, it makes sense. Because what if the prosecution, I don't advise this, but what if the prosecution waited and called the most important witness last? I never call the most important witness last, but I usually called a pretty important witness last. What if a defendant testifies last? He's the last, or she's the last witness called by the defense. What sense does it make that you've already made up your mind if you haven't heard from the most important witness? So can you wait? Can you wait until every piece of evidence has been introduced, examined, and cross-examined? And you're going to be asked that. And so then, armed with all of that information, those who are found qualified, those who don't have non-refundable vacation trips, those who don't have small children at home for whom they're the primary caregiver, or, you know, a very sick parent. I mean, people have lives. They can't put them on hold for 8 to 10 hours every day for weeks and weeks and weeks. So once all of that is sorted out and you're armed with all of that information, and I should stop right here and say, in some states, the judges ask all of these questions. In some states, the lawyers get to ask these questions. And I was in a state where it was a little bit of both. Usually it was the judge asking these questions. But in death penalty cases, the lawyers got to do it. We would spend hours on a single potential juror trying to find out whether or not that juror was qualified. And to be qualified in a death penalty case, you have to be able to give both life and death. You can't be an eye for an eye kind of person, and you can't be a no death penalty person. Then you're not qualified. You have to be able to say both yes and no. And the only way to figure that out is to question each member, each potential member of that jury panel individually, which is why it took days, if not weeks, to draw a jury in a death penalty case. So armed with all of that information, names are either electronically or by someone in the clerk's office pulled. You're assigned a juror number. Maybe you are juror number 45. And this is one area where jurisdictions do it differently, but I'm going to give it the way that I am most familiar with. I'll give you two ways. I've been in trials where the judge will ask juror number 45 to walk to the front of the courtroom. So imagine that. You're juror number 45. You've already had to answer some really personal questions. You have to walk in front of God and everybody else to the front of the courtroom. And a lawyer is asked, usually the prosecution first, seat the juror or excuse the juror. And so the prosecution will either say, seat the juror or excuse the juror. Then you go to the defense. The defense will either say, seat the juror or excuse the juror. If both the state and the defense agree, then that person is on the jury. That's what seat the juror means. Put them in a seat. Wait right there. We'll have more next.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
This is where it gets fun, and this is where the strategy is involved. Both sides get a certain number of strikes. You can say, I don't want that person on the jury. In South Carolina, I got five. I think I got five. Maybe I got six. I think I got five. It's been a long time, and I'm old. I either got five or six. But I know this, the defendant got a lot more than I got. So five times I could say, thank the juror for his or her service in this case. He or she may be dismissed. I never said strike the juror or get rid of the juror or I don't think the juror can be fair. I was always very polite about it. This is where the psychology of it comes in. Who do you want? I mean, who are you looking for? I was not looking for young people usually on my juries. I just wasn't. I love young people. I lived with two of them. I once was one. I teach them. I love young people, but that does not mean I wanted them to be on my jury. In a sexual assault case, almost every major decision maker in my life is a woman. I trust women with parts of my life that I trust no one else. I would never trust a man. But in certain categories of cases, I wanted male jurors and not female jurors. Now, legally, you cannot strike someone solely on the basis of race, sex, or age. So you have to come up with something other than, I don't want that person because that person's a man. Requires a little bit of ingenuity, but not a whole lot to come up with something other than gender to explain why you did not want that person on the jury. But you get to do that. So that's the process. A juror, you either do it on paper where you get a list of names and you strike and say, I get five strikes, but the defense attorney gets 10 strikes. In some of my trials, we did it in person. The juror literally walked to the front of the courtroom, and you're staring at another person, and they have this helpless look in their eyes because it's almost like, you know, why do you not want me? Why would you say, please excuse the juror? And it's never personal. I mean, there are people like, I mean, I don't really think I'm ever going to do this again, so I'll go ahead and share all my little tricks of the trade with you. I wasn't a huge fan of having psychologists on my jury or sociologists. I wasn't a huge fan of having counselors on the jury. I mean, I was not looking for sympathy in my jurors. The defense attorney was, but I wasn't. So the fact that I struck someone might be because they worked in the sociology department at the local college. They're sitting there wondering, what did I do wrong? What do you know about me that I don't know? Why would you not seat me? And it could just be because of my overgeneralization that college professors would lean a certain direction. That's what's so fascinating about jury selection. It is much more psychology than law, and it is much more art than science. And so now I think you get a sense that you don't pick a jury, you unpick. Names are called, and you have to save your strikes for the people that you really, really, really don't want. So if you are a defense attorney and there are spouses of law enforcement officers in the jury panel, they answered the questions correctly. No, I would not believe a police officer over anyone else. I could be fair. All of their answers were textbook correct answers. Are you really going to seat the spouse of a law enforcement officer if you're a defense attorney? I don't think so. So you're going to use your strikes. You're going to unpick that person from the jury. So then what you're left with are the 12 people that neither side really, really, really wanted, and neither side really, really, really had a huge objection to. And that was almost always, I probably did north of 100 trials. Not probably. I did north of 100 trials. That's a lot of trials, by the way. And I don't ever recall drawing a jury without feeling a couple things. Number one, did I make a mistake? Because you're trying to sum up the fairness of another human being with just your eyeballs and the answers to a couple of questions. I mean, and this is where it gets kind of silly. I mean, you pay attention to clothes, you pay attention to facial hair. Even with criminal records, that to me was not an automatic disqualifier, even though I was a prosecutor. I wanted to know how long ago it was, because sometimes it's a youthful indiscretion, and sometimes what the result is someone says, look, I did the crime and I did the time, and so should someone else. So the notion that you're automatically going to get someone who's sympathetic to a defendant because he or she himself or herself was once a defendant is just a really simple-minded way of trying to sum up human nature. And I guess that's what I love so much about jury selection. Is this incredible combination of the law, the qualifications, your judgment, your ability to read people. And that is the skill that you want most in a lawyer. I don't care what your grade point average was. I don't even really care how much you know the law, as long as somebody sitting at the table knows it. I want you to know the rules of evidence. I want you to be super quick on your feet. But I really, really want you to be able to read people. Because what this juror needs to hear is not what that juror needs to hear. And you need the ones who were picked or selected or not deselected. You don't want them being suspicious of you for why you struck the person that they'd been sitting beside for the last 3 hours. None of the cases that I prosecuted had anything to do with politics. In the almost 20 years I did it, not a single one of them had anything to do with politics. I cared whether potential jurors had good or bad experiences with law enforcement, could care less about their politics, could care less about who they voted for, what bumper stickers were on their car, because I never found that really mattered. Age mattered, and I'm confessing that between an older juror and a younger juror, I would pick an older one. But Democrats and Republicans alike did not want to be robbed or carjacked or kidnapped or worse. So politics had nothing to do with it. And I guess what I'll be watching in New York, and what I'm watching increasingly now in cases, is whether people can separate their personal political views with their verdict. It's true that some people probably want to serve in high profile cases, just like people confess to crimes they didn't really commit. But you and I will never understand the psychology of that. We can try as hard as we want to. We'll never understand why somebody would confess to a crime they did not commit. We'll never understand why somebody would lie when they're answering a judge's questions because they want to be seated on a jury. What's far more common is that people will make up reasons not to serve on a jury. It's hard. It's inconvenient. It's not always exciting. Some of the witnesses, like chain of custody witnesses, are super, super not exciting. It's thankless. But it is a fundamental part of who we are and our justice system. The government can be told no by a group of ordinary people sitting in a jury box. I mean, think about that for a second. These teachers and these mechanics and these retirees and these folks that work all manner of jobs, and they cross all boundaries, racial and gender and age, and they come together in this collective called a jury. And they have the power to say no to the United States of America, to the state of South Carolina, to the state of New York, to the state of wherever you're sitting in. It's one of the great marvels of our republic that one person can sue the biggest corporation in town and win because 12 of his or her fellow citizens thought that he or she should. So it's the first time. Everybody wants to talk about history. It's the first time a former president's gone on trial for criminal charges. Yeah, all of that's true, I suppose. You know, history has already told us what to do. It's simple. Do justice. Though the heavens fall, be just. I wish I have that phrase in Latin. Somebody gave it to me. It's one of my more treasured possessions. What a beautiful thing to contemplate. May justice be done though the heavens fall. And once you have a jury, you have opening statement, which is supremely important. I broke every rule when it came to opening statements. You know, when you're a brand new prosecutor, they send you to these schools and everybody tells you what you're supposed to do. And I used to sit there and think, well, why do you do it that way? I had a colleague, and he was a colleague. He was a dear friend of mine. He told me that I needed to wear a certain color tie every time I tried a case in front of a jury. And I remember looking at him and saying, what color tie did you have on the last time you lost a jury trial? And he said, it was a red tie. And I said, so there's nothing talismanic about wearing a red tie. I mean, you've won with a red tie and you've lost with a red tie. So I'm going to wear whatever tie I feel like wearing. I didn't follow the rules when it came to opening statement. I didn't do them the way the so-called expert said it should be done. I told a story. I told a story like we were reading this story, this narrative together, that the jury and I were walking on a journey together. And I asked the jury to be fair to both sides, to listen, to follow the judge's instructions, to hold me accountable beyond a reasonable doubt. There's a reason we have a standard that is high in criminal cases. You have someone's liberty at stake, their reputation, their freedom. I wanted the jury to hold me accountable. But I wanted them to use their common sense. I never once asked for a verdict in an opening statement. I mean, people used to laugh at me for not doing it. I mean, that was not the way to do an opening statement, according to them. Last thing I was supposed to say was, at the end of this trial, I will stand back up in front of you again and ask you to return a verdict of guilty. Why would I do that? The jury hasn't heard from a single witness. The judge just got through telling them not to make up their minds. I mean, you already know that in 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 months, you're eventually going to stand back up in front of them one last time and ask for a verdict. You know that. They don't know that. And now's not the time to do it. It ran counter to everything the jury was being asked to do. And it made the prosecutor seem like a hired gun rather than what he or she really should be, which is a minister of justice. So I never asked for a verdict in opening. The purpose of opening is to build trust with the jury, to let them know that you're an honest broker. So why not just ask them to do what they promised to do? To be fair to both sides, to listen, to wait, to use good judgment, to search for the truth. How does saying any of that get you in trouble with a jury? Yeah, you want to point out what to be looking for, what might be important, but using lots of names and dates, and you're going to hear from witness X who's going to tell you this, that, and the other, tell it in the form of a story, like you are literally telling a story to a group of friends that is exciting and it's captivating and it's leading them somewhere without them feeling manipulated. I mean, details. I mean, you really want somebody sitting there trying to remember, well, did he say that John or Joe was going to tell me what the autopsy? It doesn't matter the name of the forensic pathologist. You're going to hear from them in 4 days. You don't need to know their name today. You just need to know that the doctor is going to come in and they're going to tell you the angle that the bullet was traveling on. That's all they need to know. So my goal when I sat down from opening statement was a simple one. I just wanted the jury to think that at the time, young man, no longer a young man, but at the time, that young man would not lie to me. That was my sole purpose, an opening statement. We're going to have a busy, busy next little while when it comes to court cases. But even if we weren't talking about presidential court cases, people are fascinated by our justice system, jury selection, now you know deselection, opening statement, how it should be done, why it's important. One of these days, we'll talk about cross-examination, how to do it effectively, and then we'll talk about my favorite thing in the world, which was closing argument. That was single. I remember I had a friend, well, I don't want to call his name. He happens to be a Supreme Court justice. People can probably figure out who it is if they really try hard enough. But he was a trial judge presiding over one of the death penalty cases that I prosecuted when I was a district attorney. So he wasn't my friend for those 3 weeks. He was the judge. He ruled against me quite often now that I think about it. But he's an incredibly fair person. But after it was over and after it was all said and done, we went and had lunch a couple of weeks later, and he said, you did what is the most exciting thing you can possibly do as a lawyer, which is give summation on either side, prosecution or defense, in a capital case with somebody's life on the line. The margin for error is so thin. The stakes are so high. Closing argument was always my favorite, but do not minimize the significance of opening statement. As you follow these trials, as you follow these cases, even as you follow ones in your own local newspaper that have nothing to do with presidential politics, I want you to know how that jury was seated or picked or unpicked. And if you ever go by the courtroom, I want you to watch lawyers listen to the opening statement. And don't be afraid to say what I said, which is I wouldn't do it that way. I'll see you next week. Thank you for joining us. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.